Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome back to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to be talking about a book called How to Love Wine, a memoir and manifesto by Eric Asimov. Oh, how do I want to tease this book in this review? And I thought a lot about this, and I'm going to sum it up very succinctly. Haters going to hate, and raters going to rate. This episode is sponsored by Blinders. One of the things I talk about in my Psalm TV series study hall is there's so many ways to learn about wine, and some of them, frankly, are really fun. Blinders is a really fun card game, and you don't have to be a sommelier, you know, to identify the wines correctly. Currently, we have a special discount code for Blinders. It is reading30, reading30 for 30% off the purchase of a Blinders deck. So Eric Asimov is the chief wine critic for the New York Times, an estimable publication. And he's held that role for a while, I think at least for 20, maybe more years. But he's been working since the early 90s at the New York Times. A little backstory on him. The bulk of his career has been in journalism, and he spent several years at a few different newspapers working as some sort of editor. He was at the Hartford Courant. He was at the Chicago Sun-Times, and then has been at the New York Times as, you know, a copy editor, national news editor. And then through those years, he kind of worked his way into the dining section and then ultimately as the chief wine critic. This book came out, this is, I think, the first book this season that's not brand spanking new. This book came out in 2012. So it's been out for a minute. And it's, full disclosure, reading this book was not the first time I read it. I've actually started this book 3 times, and I've put it down twice of those 3 times. But this time I got through it. The first couple attempts, I was turned off by the tone and the content and the meandering style. And I guess something shiny attracted my attention. And so I didn't get through it. But I thought, you know what? This guy has a powerful position and an estimable reputation. So let's see what he has to say. And the book, I will say, it's about 260 pages, and that doesn't include the acknowledgments or an index. It's not a fast read. I am a fast reader. Some of the books that I review, I tear through. This one was a little bit more of a slog, and I think it's both the style and the content and my take on it. So this book, I think from the jump, the title's a little misleading, because as the chief wine critic for a major publication and a book entitled How to Love Wine, I think some people might actually think this is an instructional book, but the subtitle is key here. It's a memoir. It's a manifesto. This is about Eric Asimov's journey from childhood to, you know, relatively current day. Obviously, this book was published 9 years ago. And his love affair with wine and food and beer and all the things in between. And it honestly doesn't really talk that much about specific producers or places until at least the second half of the book, and maybe the last third. There are chapters where there's really no wine mentioned at all. So I just, you know, it might not be clear from the cover about what this book entails. As I was slogging through the first couple chapters, I kept going back to the liner notes to try to reconcile what the title is and what the content is presenting. Because I was like, wow, there's a disconnect here. This book is not teaching me how to love wine. It's really giving me the impression that Eric Asimov has a laundry list of things to criticize. I mean, he is a critic. And none of it's really wine, but he, in no specific order, goes after the concepts of tasting notes and wine ratings and wine critics and vintage charts. One by one, he tears these things apart. And let's not forget, he's a wine critic. The call is coming from inside the house. Dude, check yourself before you wreck yourself. It's really funny that he's got all the words for all the other wine critics, but I think sometimes we need to turn the magnifying glass on oneself. Now look, there's actually a lot to love in this book, and I was surprised. Well, maybe it's not that surprising, but I was surprised that we actually have a lot in common in terms of the type of things that we like to consume. And that, I guess, isn't surprising because I'm a generalist. I like all kinds of things. I kind of pride myself on being open to trying all different types of food and beverages. And look, I don't like everything, but I will try everything. And, you know, I've mentioned how I think my first sip of wine was White Zinfandel. And Eric Asimov talks about how one of his first impactful food and wine moments involved White Zinfandel. I should say, we've never met him and we have a fairly significant age difference. And so there is obviously sometimes what he's consuming and what was available throughout his memoir is very reflective of the time and the place. But, you know, he talks about how he was, you know, into beer earlier. And I think for a lot of Americans, that's our first taste of alcohol. I mean, I think, you know, when I was in high school and college, that's a lot of what we drank was beer. And he actually talks about how his first stint at reviewing was reviewing beer for his high school newspaper, which begs a few questions. What high school newspaper allowed students to review beer, even though the drinking age was 18, not 21? But that's really neither here nor there. So, and he also talks about an appreciation for like Dr. Pepper and how he worked at a summer camp. These are all things that we have in common. So I was occasionally my hackles that were, you know, kind of rising up and my annoyance and my eye rolling was occasionally mollified by the fact that like, we do have some stuff in common. We like some of the same wines. We like a lot of the same wines. We like a lot of the same importers. And he details some of the, you know, the authors of books that I've reviewed or like Neil Rosenthal, or he mentions Alice Firing. And so these are authors of books that I've reviewed previously. And so the wine world is small. So, you know, it's surprising, but it's also not really surprising. But this book, as I mentioned from the jump, it was a little bit of a struggle for me because there were little mentions that I found kind of annoying or offensive right in the get-go. And like on the third page, he starts talking about his big frustration is that he feels that wine is made to be exclusive and mysterious. And that's the biggest problem, is that consumers feel anxiety and insecurity about wine because they don't know how to talk about it. They don't understand it. And so it sounds like this would be an opportunity to make wine more approachable and understandable, but it doesn't always go in that direction. You know, on page two, he talks about how in fancier restaurants, sommeliers have taken it upon themselves to give wine an initial taste. And that's something that happens to determine if the wine is sound. Now I know, you know, restaurants have been closed in a lot of places around the country for the past year, but depending on the style of the restaurant, the manager, the server, the sommelier might present a bottle to whomever ordered it and they might taste it, or the sommelier might taste it. And I've worked in both styles of restaurants, and the idea simply for a sommelier to taste it is to eliminate the possibility that a flawed wine makes it to the table. Not everybody, not every consumer understands that. And so I personally used to always kind of just mention that offhand. Present the bottle. Here's what you ordered, ma'am. I'm going to check the bottle for soundness. I'll be right back. You know, you mention it and it puts people at ease. Then they know they don't have to worry about anything. There won't be a pop quiz at the end of the evening. But he says, of course, this practice has given rise to the suspicion that by pouring a taste for themselves, the sommeliers are somehow bilking customers by giving them less than a full bottle. Sir, no. You pour yourself like less than an ounce. It's a tiny taste, and any sommelier worth their snuff does this in sight of the customer. So don't reiterate stupid debunked claims, because it only serves to perpetrate the myth. So that on page two, you know, as a sommelier, that bothered me just a shade. But then in chapter two, and keep in mind, my first two attempts at this book, I didn't get past the first two chapters. But in chapter two, he discusses the 21st century wine connoisseur. There's just a little bit of what I call it like subtle sexism. He talks about, with no names, he's just talking in abstract, who this connoisseur is. And he talks about how she may live in a fifth floor walk-up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. She pays her rent with part-time jobs, and she wants to, you know, drink well, but she has wines and crates in her teeny tiny little studio apartment, and she dreams of, you know, being able to buy an experience and travel. Or maybe the other 21st century wine connoisseur, makes a lot of money working in arbitrage in downtown Manhattan, and he's got a place on the coast. And I just think to myself, oh God, just painting stereotypes of who the connoisseurs are, and the guy is wealthy, successful financier, and the woman is struggling to get by teaching yoga. And look, maybe that wouldn't even catch anyone else's attention, but those two things kind of set me off on a tone. That said, the real meat of this book is this repeated idea that, you know, wine is confusing, wine needs to be demystified, and how do we go about doing that, and what are the problems with that? And one of the first big kind of takedowns is called, it's in a chapter called The Tyranny of the Tasting Note. And the idea of tasting notes, whether they appear in magazines or newspapers or in what we call shelf talkers, they're like little cards that appear in retail shops that give a brief description, a couple of sentences of what to expect you know, from the wine, what the wine tastes like or smells like. I'll be the first to admit, sometimes there's a fair amount of poetic license, maybe too much, that gets invoked in writing tasting notes. And he quotes some, and I'll read this because it's pretty funny. He took a couple of examples from Wine Spectator magazine, and he says, this one particular wine was described as still tightly wound with a brooding core of mulled currant, warm fig sauce, and Maduro tobacco, liberally laced with tapenade and lavender notes. The finish is long and grippy. Now that's poetic, right? And he talks about how that actually gives you nothing, no expectation of what the wine would be. I actually kind of have an idea of what that wine is going to be like. Now, I also work in the wine profession and I've tasted a lot of wines, but I did have a really fortunate experience for a couple of years. There's a big wine competition. It used to be called the Dallas Morning News Wine Competition. And then it was purchased by Texom, which is a big wine and spirits conference. But the Texom International Wine Awards take place, well, right about now, usually in the winter. And what happens is wine professionals, wine writers, maybe even Eric Asimov at some point, I don't know, are invited to blind taste wine, ciders. I think it's just wines and ciders and maybe some fruit wines. But there are thousands of bottles that are submitted. An army of volunteers ensures that they are opened, they are at the correct temperature, and they're all served blind. And then judges, esteemed industry professionals, experts at their craft, will taste them based on category, and then they will award a gold, a silver, or no award. And then one of the cool things is that the Texom International Wine Awards had and has had for years like a sommelier like training ground, a sommelier retreat, I guess is the best way to describe it. And one of the perks of that retreat is that actual wine journalists were there, and they would teach a little class to the sommelier volunteers on wine writing. We would actually get instruction on how to write a successful tasting note, when the award-winning wines would come back blind and the sommelier volunteers would taste them, and then we would write up tasting notes for them for eventual publication in the Texom International Wine Awards like magazine. And we would get feedback. This isn't very descriptive. That's a little bit too flowery. This is a little bit too poetic. And so I actually, you know, I have had a little bit of amateur experience with that, and it's not that easy. It takes some work. And again, I think the goal with these tasting notes, you know, flowery though they may be, is to try to draw somebody in. And Eric Asimov, he's really got no patience for them. He says at best, tasting notes are a waste of time. At worst, they are pernicious. It's disturbing to imagine wine writers racking their brains to decide whether a particular aroma reminds them of braised fig or roasted fig or fig sauce or Maduro tobacco, but writers need to feel useful. And so he doesn't just diss the idea of a tasting note, he actually names names. He seems to take a great deal of umbrage with a writer from the Wine Spectator named James Molesworth. Now, I've never met Eric Asimov. I don't know James Molesworth. I think I've met him once or twice. And James Molesworth used to cover the wines of Bordeaux for Wine Spectator. I believe he does Wines of California now. And he really laced into a few different write-ups of James Molesworth about wines. And apparently, like a human might do, he repeats himself occasionally with descriptors. You know, uses the same term of Maduro tobacco for more than one wine. And Eric Asimov just doesn't understand why that could be, why that's necessary. It bothers him to no end. Like, it really seems to bother him. Now, I just take that as like, it's tobacco. So maybe he's using a descriptor. And Maduro tobacco typically refers to the cured tobacco that is used as a wrapper for a cigar. And cigar, tobacco, these are notes that we get in wine. We meaning like people all over the world who have tasted and attempted to put word to wine and describe it. And it's just a hunch. But Marvin Schenken Productions owns both the Wine Spectator and Cigar Aficionado. There might be some cross-pollination with the people who read both of those periodicals. And so maybe by using that term, this is all just my hypothesis, but maybe James Molesworth is a Cigar Aficionado himself. Maybe he knows what that tastes like and smells like, and he likes it. But also maybe he knows that his readers might understand what that is. I don't know. It's just a hunch. But there's probably a reason for that. And boy, Eric Asimov has got absolutely no use for it. And it bothers me because I think the idea, just because you don't like the way a wine is described, I think it's because those terms are used to describe wines that Eric Asimov doesn't like. And so, yeah, the words might be poetic, but is it because he doesn't like the words or he doesn't like the wine? So I don't find tasting notes tyrannical. I think that they are helpful. I think that they serve a important purpose, but they are not part of how Eric Asimov wants you to learn to love wine. One of the next things that he criticizes in this book is the idea of formal wine education. Now, I've mentioned it before, I teach wine classes. I have for a long time. And so as a sommelier, as a teacher, I guess I took a little bit of personal slight to the fact that some of the things that are criticized in this book are things that are passions of mine. And I guess if I want to be fair, Eric Asimov took a wine class once. He literally went to one wine class. He said it was at an estimable wine school in Manhattan. Doesn't name it, and that's fine. And the class, based on his description, maybe wasn't the best first experience. I teach beginner classes all the time. And in fact, sometimes in beginner classes, we don't even sit down and taste like lots and lots of wines. You might taste a red and a white. And my hunch is he maybe didn't get a great experience because he seemed really puzzled that everyone was tasting the same set of wines, and yet everyone would say something different about them, and the teacher would essentially say, yes, correct, to everyone. But guess what? Wine is subjective, and we aren't all going to taste the same things in the wine. And he seemed to get a little bit kind of frustrated or annoyed that I guess they were tasting a Sauvignon Blanc, and it was blind at the time. They didn't know what the wine was, and they went around the table and one person said the wine was pungent and someone else said it smelled like a taxicab deodorizer. And Eric Asimov said that it smelled like mint and tarragon. And someone else said that it smelled like grass and nectarines. And the instructor said, yes, I'm getting that too, along with whetstones and gooseberries. I could tell you just reading all of those descriptions that they were probably tasting a Sauvignon Blanc. And look, you may never have had a gooseberry. I was well into my adulthood years before I ever had one. But you can find them at farmers markets throughout the United States. And they look like perfectly round green grapes. And I swear to goodness, when you taste one, if you've ever had Sauvignon Blanc before, I bet your reaction might be like mine. And I was like, whoa, that tastes like Sauvignon Blanc. There's a reason that fruit has been used as a descriptor for Sauvignon Blanc. And look, wine tasting notes are a subject, you know, a controversial subject because your vocabulary to describe wine is based on your personal experiences. But if you broaden your experiences, you'll realize that there is actually a fairly large vocabulary of words that you can use to describe the wine. And none of those people is necessarily wrong. Now, taxicab deodorizer is not a very positive descriptor, but grass, nectarines, tarragon, gooseberries, stones, sounds fairly Sauvignon Blanc-y to me. But he found the class puzzling and, well, he went the one time and he never went back. And not only did he never go back, he never felt the inclination to return for another class. And he says that he's not denigrating them. They have their proper time and place. But at that point, he was getting too serious about wine. Apparently too serious to learn some of the like nuts and bolts of it. And I think that brings me to one of my bigger frustrations with this book is that I don't doubt Eric Asimov's knowledge. I think he has had tremendous privilege and exposure to a lot of wines. And I think he probably knows a lot. This book is not going to teach you a lot other than what he doesn't like. And it's going to tell you about his path. But as a teacher, I can tell you that people learn differently. And some people are experiential. Some people are didactic. They use their words. Some people are, you know, spatial and they like to, you know, like imagine things and they're very visual. Everybody learns differently. And there's no wrong way to learn, especially when it comes to wine. Wine is inherently personal and subjective. And so if somebody else prefers to read the opinion of a trusted advisor, whether it's Eric Asimov or James Molesworth, more power to you. If somebody shops with their eyes, as we know consumers do in retail stores, and they read a couple of lines on a shelf talker in a retail store, more power to you. They're buying wine. Like that's our goal, right? To get people to drink more wine. But further on in the book, you know, Eric Asimov nails other wine critics, and he hates the way they talk, again, with apparently a complete lack of self-awareness that he, at this point where the book was published, was himself a wine critic. And also ratings. And he talks about the evolution of the 100-point scale. This is popularized by Robert Parker, and it's been used all over the world. Our British counterparts maybe had like a 20-point scale. And essentially the idea is you would taste a wine and you would rate it. And he takes apart with very valid criticisms the problems with having a 100-point wine scale. The idea is that some wines taste better when they're young and some wines taste better when they're older. This is subjective. And when you are rating wines in their youth, that maybe the wines that show best in their youth are going to get higher scores, and the wines that need some time to mature are not going to get as highly rated. It is just one tool in the arsenal of a wine consumer's, you know, wine appreciation toolbox. So it's not without merit. Is it overly simplified? Yes. Do some people take it too seriously? Yes. Do some people only ever want to have 100-point wines and have dinners with themes of 100-point wines? Yes. And I know this because I've worked as a sommelier at 100-point wine dinners. It's a, like a theme of having, I don't know, all wines from a particular region or all, you know, different wines made by the same winemaker. It's just a theme and it is over, you know, heavily utilized, but it's not the end of the world because I do believe it provides a lexicon or a scale for people who don't otherwise know to help make some decisions. And look, they might still find they don't like the wines. Simply choosing based on tasting notes or a 100-point scale doesn't mean you'll like the wine and it doesn't mean you'll keep buying the wine. It just provides a little bit of assistance to someone who is actively seeking outside counsel. If you didn't want anyone else's opinion, you would ignore all those things and you are perfectly within your rights as a consumer to not listen to what anyone says about wine, including Eric Asimov, and just drink what you like. And that's fine too. Now, as I mentioned, the book doesn't really detail too many specific wines or places or producers until the second half of the book. Now, if it sounds like I'm on a tear for just criticizing this book, it's not all bad. There's some really charming stories. And one of my favorites, it's about halfway through the book, and the scene is set in 1985. And Eric Asimov's parents are celebrating their 30th anniversary, their 30th wedding anniversary. And he wanted his family to share a memorable bottle from the same vintage as their marriage, which is a really sweet idea. That's one of the cool things about wine, right? It allows you to time travel. He wasn't alive when his parents got married, but if they were to share a bottle made from grapes that were picked the year his parents got married, it could kind of like, it could be the social lubricant and the connection and a cool story. Plus, it would be an interesting bottle of wine to taste. So he does mention that he didn't know a whole lot about wine. He had never tasted an old wine. And other than the fact that he liked to drink wine, he didn't know how it aged or evolved. And so he did seek out the advice of, you know, of friends of other people. And it was suggested to him that perhaps he should look for a wine from Bordeaux. Now, wines from Bordeaux are storied. They've been made for centuries and they make all styles, sparkling red, white, rosé, sweet. Their highest end red wines. And the wines of Bordeaux are by and large a blend of different grape varieties, depending on where they come from. But Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Cabernet Franc are the main grapes. But six grapes are allowed by law. New law, some experimental grapes have been approved to combat climate change. That's a whole other story. But as it turns out, he was, he's kind of reminiscing. And keep in mind, with the cost of living and inflation, prices have changed. And so in the 1980s, he's talking about how you could find a bottle of Lafite Rothschild, which is a first growth. It's considered some of the highest quality for like $50 or $60. And now that is easily going to be four digits. And so it is interesting to think about just how relatively affordable some of the world's greatest wines were at that time. But he sought the advice of someone who knew more than him, which is always a good idea. And he talks a little bit about the what's called the 1855 classification in Bordeaux. Essentially, the 60 best producers of the time, based on the prices the wines fetched, were ranked in advance of the World Exposition in Paris. And so they were ranked in five tiers, first growth being the best, followed by second, third, fourth, and fifth. It was not exhaustive. It only included wines from one side of the river, from the left bank. There have been a few edits over the years, but by and large, it stood the test of time. And he was turned on to a bottle of 1955 Chateau La Mission Aubryon. And it cost him in 1985, $185. Now, look, that's a lot of money. $185 isn't chump change to spend on a bottle of wine. If you've never enjoyed the wines of Chateau La Mission Aubryon, they're so good. I love them. And I, at one time in my career, had the opportunity to work as a volunteer sommelier for an event featuring wines of La Mission Aubryon and Chateau Aubryon, which is a first growth of Bordeaux. Many, many vintages, these wines age in extraordinary fashion. And he was shocked and appalled. Wow, almost $200 for a bottle of wine. Like, oh my God, this is crazy. And adjusting for rates of inflation, certainly that bottle of wine would be a lot more expensive now if you could get it, because as time goes on, wines get consumed, there's less of them available. And he didn't really know anything about it. He hoped it would be good. He didn't know how to serve it. If it would be bad, he'd never had a corked wine. He didn't know how it had been stored. In fact, he didn't even know if that was a question he should have asked. And he enjoyed it for dinner with his parents. At their house, his mom had made lamb chops, which is a classic accompaniment to red Bordeaux. And they opened up the wine and they really, really enjoyed it. And the story is really charming. I love the idea of celebrating momentous occasions with a bottle of wine from that vintage. I think it's sweet, right? And a bottle of wine doesn't fulfill its destiny until it's consumed. And so I've said before, I'm not a huge fan of trophy collections or museum cellars where you just buy wine for the sake of buying it. I think celebrating it, drinking it with friends and family, I think Erica Asimov and I would agree on that, is the best way to do it. But he describes the wine and how it was delicious and it was memorable and it was mesmerizing. But he says, nobody should feel obliged to stop and study this and you know, look into the details and describe it. He was like, it was really good. And he was like, I guess I could technically describe it using terms like flowers and herbs and spices and pencil shavings and violets. And he's like, I suppose that would be correct on a vague level. But he was like, I think it's just better to say that each sip was both a joy and a challenge. Well, that's great. But you know what? Someone who might never have the access to that wine might be curious what it tastes like and why it would be good 30 years later. And look, there are certain attributes that some wines possess that allow them to age well, to improve with time in the bottle. And the vast majority is most wines aren't meant to age, nor will they improve in the bottle, but some will. And the characteristics, which maybe would have been covered in the second class he didn't go to, are that the structural elements that give wine the potential, they don't mean it will age, but give wine the potential to age include high levels of acidity, high levels of tannin, and or high levels of sugar. You really don't find all three of those things together in a wine, but some combination of those things. As it turns out, the wines of Bordeaux, the red wines, they are both high in acid and high in tannins. So in a good year, and 1955 was a good year, in fact, some would argue, a lot of people would argue, that Chateau La Mission Aubryon was maybe one of the wines of the vintage. That is a wine that can age for decades. So there's actually a little bit of theory behind that. And I don't think that that's a bad thing to learn or a bad thing to share or a bad thing to know, especially if you are plunking down hundreds of dollars for a bottle. I think a little bit of information and a little bit of study and a little bit of informed consumption is a good idea. It's also interesting because he does completely dismiss the idea of a vintage chart because like a 100-point rating scale, it's a crutch that is overused. The history of vintages is interesting. Bordeaux enjoys a climate which is what we would consider a moderate maritime climate. It has plenty of precipitation. It has four distinct seasons, but it's, you know, moderated by its proximity to a large body of water. But every vintage is different. So the weather changes every single year, even if the overarching climate is relatively consistent. And it's an interesting story that while 1955 was a beneficial and heralded vintage for lots of producers, in 1956 in Bordeaux, there was a disastrous severe frost and freeze. And it was so severe that it killed vines. And it was so severe that lots of old vines died. I don't think you would ever be able to find a 1956 Bordeaux out there because yields were so low. And old vines were ripped out and oftentimes not planted. I mentioned just a hot second ago that while the major grapes of Bordeaux are Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Cabernet Franc, six grapes are allowable by law for red wines, not including these new experimental varieties. In addition to those big three, which are the vast majority of what's planted, it is also permissible to plant Carmenere, Petit Verdot, and Malbec. Now, Malbec is not something that we associate with Bordeaux anymore. It is the grape of Cahors further south in France, and it's definitely the star grape of Argentina. But a lot of old vine Malbec died. It was killed in the 1956 freeze, and it wasn't replanted. It was replanted for more popular and more vigorous and more productive varieties like Merlot, which is now the number one planted grape variety in Bordeaux. So a little bit of education, a little bit of context. It's actually pretty interesting in the big picture of things. But Erica Asimov just wants you to drink the wine and ignore all of the kind of the background noise. And that's fine, but it doesn't have to be the only way. Now, I do, like I said, he has a lot of criticisms and disagreements and, I don't know, a fairly curmudgeonly attitude towards a lot of things. But I think one of the things that bothered me so much about this book, and I don't know how else to say it, is not a lot of acknowledgement for his privilege and his luck. And again, I've not met him. I don't know him. And I do believe he knows a whole lot about wine. And I think that a lot of that has come from a job that he maybe lucked into a little bit. So back to his biography. Eric Asimov, you know, spent a year in Chicago at the Sun-Times, and then he decided he wasn't really happy there and he wanted to move elsewhere. And he applied for editor jobs, and he narrowed it down to an opportunity in Pennsylvania, and then he got an offer from the New York Times. And he worked there as a national news editor. And then in the early 90s, he, as an enthusiastic lover of food, kind of pitched an idea. He had been working on ingratiating himself with the wine writer at the Times, and then also sort of the whole dining section of the paper generally. And he had kind of pitched this idea that for a long time, the restaurant reviews had focused on high-end restaurants. And that was sort of ignoring the changing landscape in Manhattan. And it was ignoring lower priced or ethnic venues, as opposed to the focus on like Michelin-starred fine dining restaurants. And so he suggested that maybe that could be an opportunity to, you know, draw some attention and to focus on that segment of the restaurant community. In the chapter called Passion Rewarded, we learn a little bit about how Eric Asimov made the jump from newspaper editor to restaurant reviewer to wine critic. And he does admit that at the time, his primary means of learning about wine was reading Wine Spectator and Robert Parker Jr., who is an influential wine critic detailed in previous books that I reviewed. And he, you know, he believed that that was kind of important for him to develop his knowledge of wine. That's about all he knew. He was reading some magazines. He was reading an influential critic. He had went to that one class. But he, in 1992, he was kind of pitching this idea of the idea of a column called 25 and Under. So restaurant reviews for affordable eating. And he says he was asked to be on a committee to decide who would write the new column. And by this time, he was now the editor of the living section of the paper, which the dining section was kind of included in that. And he was happily immersed in this world of food and wine. And he worked with an incredibly talented team of reporters as their editor. And he says, wait for it, perhaps I was too self-absorbed. But when we were meeting with this new committee, we tackled the issue right away. Who should write this new column? And half joking, he said, what about me? And as far as he was concerned, he says this, he was the perfect person for this job. He did have an entire staff of highly talented reporters, but he was the perfect person because this was his dream. Because from a meal he had when he was 14 years old in Paris, he had been obsessed with restaurants. Had I been trained as a chef? No. Had I ever worked in a restaurant? Well, as a teenager, I'd been a busboy. So the answer is not really. I'd never cooked professionally. Yet I had little doubt that I knew the difference between a good meal and a bad one, between a warm, welcoming restaurant where food was prepared with passion and care and an indifferent place that went through the motions. I felt as if I was the ultimate restaurant consumer and that I knew what I was doing because I had been doing it for decades. The difference now is that I was writing too. I underlined that passage and I read it quoting because I thought, wow, that's impressive. And I'm going to diverge for just a second because it's interesting to me. There is there's a meme, and you can now buy mugs and tote books and things like that. And it's been circulating around on the interwebs for a minute. And it's basically advice to women from a feminist angle. And it says, carry yourself with the confidence of a mediocre white man. And look, to any mediocre white men who are listening to this podcast, that's actually a compliment because studies have shown that men don't suffer from imposter syndrome nearly as much as women do. Studies have proven that women are more hesitant to apply for positions, for jobs, unless they feel they are 100% qualified for the position, whereas men who are only maybe feel they're only 50 or 60% qualified will go for it. They will lean on in. They have no chill about thinking maybe they're not the best person for the job. They will full speed ahead. And I thought, well, there you go. And I'm not trying to say that Eric Asimov is a mediocre white man now. He might have been then because he had no professional background or expertise. What he had was unmitigated confidence in himself that he was the person for the job because he really liked to eat. Props to you, sir, because, you know, you have to believe in yourself. And self-confidence is a struggle for a lot of people. And it's funny because this book talks about so much wine anxiety and how to demystify stuff and how to make people feel more confident. And it's funny because it doesn't seem like Eric Asimov has ever suffered from a lack of confidence. Now, that column ran for years. And then ultimately in the late 90s, the idea from the New York Times to have a wine editor, not just a wine or a wine critic, not just a wine writer, kind of came about. They approached him as someone who could write that column. He had demonstrated his interest in wine as both an editor and now a writer. And when he was approached with the idea, he cannonballed into the deep end. He does say, "I suppose the Times could have hired an expert for the column they had just given to me. But what, after all, would an expert have offered that I could not?" True, an expert might have been far better schooled in the history and context of wine. My knowledge and experience with the benchmark bottles of the world was still painfully slight. I couldn't yet discourse on great Bordeaux vintages, clearly, or recite the communes of the Côte d'Or. I was lacking in professional measures. I couldn't name various appellations in the Languedoc, or enumerate from memory the 13 grapes, or was it 12, permitted in Châteauneuf-du-Pape? But can't even. But my attitude was, that's what reference books are for. I wasn't being asked to produce a technical treatise on malolactic fermentation or on the soil composition of Napa Valley. In fact, it had been my experience that such information in the hands of the wrong writer or sommelier could be turned into a pedantic weapon. Not that I thought ignorance was bliss, but I felt instinctively that I understood what people wanted to know about wine, and I hoped I could tell them in an engaging, unthreatening manner. I want to throw open my mouth a little bit, but the best part is the next chapter is entitled The Importance of Being Humble. And at that point, I actually had to close the book and walk away. Now, when I came back to it and I read the chapter, the funny part is The Importance of Being Humble actually refers to winemakers and the humility that some of the world's great winemakers have. It's just really hilarious to me about this like incredible like belief in self, which is great. It's just like, I guess that just probably wouldn't happen today. I mean, if I cold called the New York Times, if Eric Asimov announced he was leaving and was like, "Hey, I really love wine. I think I'd like to be your wine critic." Or even if someone who had worked there for a long time, because I've never worked in journalism and I'm not a writer, was just like, "I really believe in myself." Great. That's fantastic. But I got to believe that maybe he stumbled into this job with a combination of incredible self-confidence and self-belief and also a fair amount of luck. And I think he's done really good things with that. I think he has taken the opportunity to travel and to write and to taste and to meet people and turn it into something. Again, I don't doubt his knowledge now, but back then, hoo boy, it's impressive. So the book is called How to Love Wine. And by page 208 out of like 250, Eric does actually tell you how to love wine. And I should subtext this and say how to love wine like Eric. He suggests that you homeschool yourself, that the best education you can possibly have is at your own dinner table, and you will open the bottles at your own leisure, and you'll get to know your own tastes, and you'll drink them at your own time. But he said you need to pop bottles. And look, I do agree. It's not tasting wine is a huge impediment to learning about wine. It's also one of the great pleasures about learning about wine is tasting alongside. But he does offer a little bit of a structure, and he says that the first thing that you need to do is to identify a good wine shop near you. We've talked a little bit in previous reviews how that can be a challenge depending on where you live in the country and where you live in the world. And he details, it's nothing new, about, you know, what makes a good wine shop. And then he says, ask the salesperson to select a mixed case of different wines, ideally 6 red and 6 white, and you can give a price point. But look, even while I'm a proponent for buying wines by the case, because almost every retailer gives you a case discount, you're still going to be shelling out a couple $100. So this is not always the easiest and most accessible way to learn about wine. And he says, now comes the fun. Every night or however often seems right, open one of the bottles with dinner. This is important. And then you need to keep a journal with some notes about your experiences. Write down all the pertinent information about the wine, the producer, the appellation, the sub-appellation, if it has one, and the vintage. And also what you ate with it and if there was anything particularly you liked about it. Again, if I was talking to someone who knew nothing about wine and I started telling them that they need to write about sub-appellations and appellations, they might look at me and say, I don't know what you're referring to. A little bit of background information to help decipher what's on a bottle of wine is actually really helpful because in the New World, outside of Europe, the place, the name of the grape, the name of the winery. It's all going to be on there. But Eric Asimov has rightfully been criticized because it's thought that he has a very old world palate. He prefers European wines. There's nothing wrong with that. There's wonderful wines in Europe. But depending on where the wines come from, it is going to be a label in maybe a foreign language, but the grape won't even be on there. There is this kind of bar of knowledge that's almost required to understand what is actually in the glass and in the bottle. And so it's great to buy a mixed case of red and white wines. And what a luxury to be able to sit down and pop a bottle of wine every night. I don't know that everybody has that ability. Maybe Eric's wife was taking care of their little children at the time. Like maybe they had a nanny, but I don't know. I was talking to one of my friends who's not in the wine industry about this, and she just laughed in my face and said, well, that's a nice idea. I don't think that's something I could do every single night. So I think his instructions were appropriate for him, and it's how he learned to love wine. But I don't think his trajectory and journey is something that is going to resonate with everyone. It's a great idea, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with buying a mixed case of wine and popping bottles and keeping a journal. But I also don't think there's anything wrong with subscribing to all kinds of periodicals and listening to what a critic says and reading tasting notes and looking at a vintage chart. I mean, every year is different in certain places around the world, and that can provide context. And context is really important. In fact, that's one of the things that he really hates about tasting notes and vintage charts is because he says that people don't take context in them, but I think that they actually provide context. So we're just going to have to agree to disagree. Now, at the very end of this book, he finally starts detailing some great producers. And look, there's a lot of them that I really love. And so I was finally feeling like this is a wine book that a critic wrote that was, you know, talking about wine as opposed to his memoir. And right as I was starting to come around in my thoughts and my feelings on this book, there's a paragraph at the very end of this book. And I thought, yeah, that's kind of my frustration. So he has a style and a preference, and it aligns with a lot of people. It aligns with some of my preferences too. He really prefers wines, you know, without any kind of marketing. He prefers less intervention, even though wine is inherently an interventionist process, or winemaking is an interventionist process. But he's got a palate and a perspective. Nothing wrong with that. And he says, I have my own interests too. I want continued access to the wines that I love and to wines that I don't even know that I love yet, but I'm sure I'll discover in the future. I believe that I can maintain access to these wines by encouraging a demand for the sorts of wines that I love. And I believe that that demand will rise from a growing audience of people who can see beyond the points and the notes of the blind tastings. So he knows what he likes. And if he uses the power of his pen to hype the wines he likes, that will create and continue the demand and the insurance of the supply for the kind of wines he likes. It is very self-serving. And look, he's a critic. He's allowed to have his own opinion. But I'm reminded of the words of some very influential musicians that had an impact on my life, Salt and Peppa. And I believe they said it best when they say, opinions are like assholes and everybody's got one. And so he's got opinions, but I have them too. And you should make up your own opinions and don't let his instruction manual on how to like wines like Eric Asimov be your guide to figure out how to love wines. Because I think that that is a very individual and personal process. And this is one hot take. Whew. All right. So for what worked, I mean, look, a lot did work. The man worked as a newspaper editor for a long time. So it is a well-written, well-edited book. No spelling errors. There's no varietal hoo-ha. It is a very well-written book. It does skip around a lot. And on a fourth pass through the first chapter, he actually does kind of acknowledge that fact and kind of apologize for the fact that it might skip around. And so I'm so glad I read that again, because I wish I'd caught it in the first four times going through, but I guess I was distracted by the other things. It is a little bit rambling, but it is really well written. There is some information on some really great producers who he loves, who I love, who probably a lot of people love. But it's just a bitch session in so many ways. I mean, he got real lucky. I don't know. I mean, maybe a lot of people have similar turns of luck in their career, and maybe a lot of people just really got what they got because of hard work and study and knowledge and putting in the sweat equity. So I don't know if his journey is inspiring and enlightening, or maybe it's a little bit to like give you some green-eyed monster characteristics, but it's It's a hard read. I didn't love it. And so for my rating, this is 100% a be aware. The thing that Eric Asimov really kind of sums up is that he doesn't want consumers to be overly influenced by marketing, by shelf talkers, by ratings and reviews, because, you know, he's a wine critic, but to really find out what they love on their own. So to that end, I'm going to turn that rationale on this book. This book is written by a very influential person in the wine world. He is the chief wine critic of the New York Times. And it is, in the title says it's a manifesto. That should maybe make you think that you should read this book. But upon future, upon further discovery and pouring through this book multiple times, I don't know that I could recommend it. So just be aware. That's my rating. And that's the hot take. So thank you so much for tuning in and for listening. Please be sure to subscribe. If you like what you heard, by all means, feel free to leave us a rating. See you next week. This episode was sponsored by Blinders. Blinders is a fun and addictive card game that can help you improve your ability to identify wine blind. And currently there is a special discount code. You can get Blinders for 30% off using the discount code READING30. That's READING30 for 30% off the Blinders game today.